Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hi, everyone. Producer Jake here. In case you haven't heard, we've released a limited edition... Hi, everyone. Producer Jake here. In case you haven't heard, we've released a limited edition poster called Robo Washington Crossing the Delaware, which, as you might have guessed, is our post-apocalyptic take on the famous painting. The artwork is by Josh Lynch, who did our original logo, as well as the fantastic art for our friends over at Blowback, and we're really excited with how it came out. Orders will be open until Friday, July 11th, so get yours now at AmericanPrestigeStore.com. Again, that's AmericanPrestigeStore.com, or just click the link in the show notes. Paid subscribers get 50% off, so subscribe now to take advantage of that deal. This is print to order, so the posters will be printed and orders will be fulfilled after July 11th. Thanks again for all your support, and enjoy the episode.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Derek Davison, joined as always by my friend and comrade Danny Bessner, and we are very pleased to welcome to the program Mark Weisbrot. He's an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and we're going to be doing some talking about sanctions. So, Mark, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the real meat of this, which is the nexus between sanctions and migration, basically migration flows, let's start at a more basic level and define what we're talking about when we talk about sanctions. There are different kinds of sanctions. The U.S. uses sanctions in different ways. When you guys talk about the linkage between sanctions and outflows of people from countries that are targeted, what kind of sanctions are we talking about, and what sort of effect do they have?
Yeah, well, we focused on the broad economic sanctions. So these are sanctions that basically target the population. And I want to emphasize that because I think this is the way, this is the main thing that people need to understand, the reason they can get away with these sanctions that kill really hundreds of thousands of people a year. And we'll be putting out more of our research on that in the coming months. But I think that we already have way more than enough evidence to say that. So the reason they can do it is because people don't know that these really target the civilian population. Broad economic sanctions being sanctions that target the financial sector, the economy, some huge part of the economy, like the oil sector in Venezuela or Iran, or, you know, in Afghanistan, where they just took away $7 billion of the central bank's reserves, which really crippled the economy. So these are what we mean by broad economic sanctions. And these lead to death and a lot of it. And that's really the most important thing. So here, I will give you an example of how people do know this, people who really think it's terribly wrong. This was Congressman Jim McGovern from Massachusetts in 2021. And he was the chair of the House Rules Committee at that time, so which is a very powerful position in Congress. And he wrote a letter to President Biden. And let me just quote a little bit from that. He said, the impact of sectoral and secondary sanctions is indiscriminate and purposely so. Although U.S. officials regularly say that the sanctions target the government and not the people, the whole point of the, quote, maximum pressure campaign, and that was what, you know, Trump was doing since 2017, is to increase the economic cost to Venezuela. Economic pain is the means by which the sanctions are supposed to work. It's not Venezuelan officials who suffer the cost, it's the Venezuelan people. So that's really, you know, he was saying as diplomatically as he could that they're really targeting the civilians. And this is, you know, this is really illegal under treaties that we have, the United States has signed, you know, the UN Charter, the Charter of the Organization of American States. And it's illegal. It's a war crime under the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Convention. And that's because it's collective punishment. And that's Article 33, the Fourth Geneva Convention. It says you can't collectively punish the civilian population. It's a war crime. And the only reason this isn't a war crime is a technicality, in that it is because there's not an actual declared war going on. And, you know, the experts at the UN have argued, pretty obvious argument, that something that's a war crime, when people are dropping bombs and shooting at each other, really should be a very serious crime when they're not. And so this is, you know, this is what we're talking about here. And we can get into the details of how it works, how it kills people, and what can be done about it as much as you want.
I would like to get a little bit into the details of how they function, and then we can move more into the effects, and that'll take us through the rest of the conversation. But, you know, we've talked about sanctions on the program occasionally before, but for people who haven't listened to those interviews or who, you know, are coming at this, you know, basically, you know, from a place of not knowing how these things work. Can you explain, you mentioned secondary sanctions, that's one category here that I think is very important, but explain how these things function, how the United States is able to impose these massive sectoral economic sanctions, broad-based, on entire countries that limit not just what that country can do, but prevent other countries, third parties from, or, you know, discourage them at least, let's say, from dealing with the targeted country. How did these things operate and what sort of mechanisms do they play on?
Yes. Well, first of all, I think the Venezuelan case has the most detail because it's been, you know, my colleague, Francisco Rodriguez, a Venezuelan economist, he's been writing about this for decades. And, you know, I've written about it as well. And so I think that's the clearest case and the, you know, the most devastating. I mean, it caused the worst depression in really the history of the hemisphere. They lost 71% of their GDP. That's, you know, that's more than twice what was lost during the Great Depression in the United States. So that's, you know, that's income of the population. And the majority of that was a result of the sanctions. And that's actually a conservative estimate because that's just taking from 2017, the Trump sanctions. But there were sanctions before that that were not as broad and still caused a lot of damage as well, starting in 2015. But yeah, if you look at how they how do they work like this? Well, in 2017, the sanctions prohibited borrowing by the Venezuelan government in U.S. financial markets, and so they couldn't restructure their foreign debt. Because, you know, you have to have new bonds to do that. So that prevented their recovery from a recession, which had already been hit by the fall in oil prices, and they would have recovered. And that also, you know, created more vulnerabilities. So that's a huge thing, you know, and it created, it pushed the country into hyperinflation. And that's another part of how they do this horrible damage, because, you know, hyperinflation is pretty much destroys an economy. But on the other hand, it isn't that hard to get rid of. If you look at the seven episodes of hyperinflation in this hemisphere, you know, since World War II, the average one lasted about 4 months. And I can go into how you can, you know, how it's gotten rid of. But the point is, you need to have access to international finance to get rid of hyperinflation. You know, there's one method that can work fairly quickly is you use the exchange rate as what economists call a nominal anchor. So you fix your currency to the dollar, let's say, and then, you know, you can put an end rather quickly often to this loss of confidence that people have in the currency, which is the underlying overwhelming cause of the hyperinflation. But you can't do anything. And so Venezuela's hyperinflation lasted for 3 years. And that's one of the reasons why you had this record destruction of caused by a depression. So that was the first. That's the first way in which sanctions can really destroy an economy, and did. And that was just the beginning of it. You know, in 2019, they cut off Venezuelan purchases of oil from the United States. That was like 600,000 barrels a day. Probably close to most of their oil sales, and so that the U.S. was buying. And then, as you mentioned, the secondary sanctions. Then they, after that, they imposed secondary sanctions, which enabled the United States, through its control of the financial system. That's a huge part of the story here too. We can talk about that. I mean, the international finance. You know, 60% of central bank reserves are in dollars, and you guys know about, you know, how much power that gives the United States. And so they used it to threaten other countries with destructive sanctions of their own if they were to buy Venezuelan oil. And so that was, and of course they recognized an unelected president, which allowed them to say that, you know, these assets that Venezuela had didn't belong to the government. And that loss, you know, that led to losses of billions of dollars of assets. For example, in 2021, the International Monetary Fund issued what are called special drawing rights, which is basically an international reserve asset that can be converted easily to cash. And they had $5 billion coming to them on the basis of their quota at the IMF. And they just cut that off, and another $2 billion was taken by the UK. And so these were huge changes as well. But, you know, the thing is, a country like Venezuela should never get into that kind of trouble. You know, I was there in 2016. There was a commission set up by the Union of South American Nations, which at that time had, you know, every South American country in it. And they set up a commission to go to Venezuela and give advice on the economy because they were already running into trouble, not the kind of trouble they had when the maximum pressure sanctions hit, but enough trouble. So this commission was formed with economists. And when that happened, you know, at that time and still today, Venezuela had 300 billion barrels of oil in the ground. And they could borrow against that if they had access to the international financial system that they would normally have. But already by that time, they didn't.
So I think this – maybe it might be worth expanding on how the international financial system and dollar hegemony allows the United States to do this. And it might be worth describing for people – we haven't done a sanctions or currency episode in a while how the system functions, where is it set up, who benefits, is it all Americans, is it just elite Americans? I think it's worth it to take kind of a 40,000-foot view of how this whole system functions.
Sure. So the dollar functions as the key currency in the world. As I mentioned, 60% of central bank reserves are still in dollars. That number hasn't changed. So these are banks' international reserves that all governments have to have on hand in order to pay for imports. And so that's what gives the U.S. such enormous power, because the dollar is, the U.S. currency. And so if you start to run out of dollars, for example, as central banks can get low on dollars, they can have what's called balance of payments crisis. And of course, that's a very serious kind of economic crisis to have. Investment flees, the economy can contract. And of course, in the extreme case like Venezuela, you can get a hyperinflation from that. And of course, the other thing is the U.S. has, the U.S. intermediaries and banks, almost all the financial transactions pass through intermediaries, that institutions that the U.S. Has control over. And so they can cut people off, cut governments off most of the time. So that dollar-based international financial system is a key to U.S. power in the world. And that's why you saw even, recently they're starting to get worried, like even Trump said something and other people in his administration, that if we abuse sanctions too much, or they didn't say abuse, but if, we use too many sanctions too often, we could lose this hegemony of the dollar. So that's not going to happen that soon. But they see that this is an enormous source of power. And of course, one of the ways it's an enormous source of power is the sanctions. But I'll get back to that more. But the point is, just having the world's currency is an enormous source of power. It allows the Fed to, for example, to open up swap lines when there's a recession hits and help the countries that they want to help. And then that makes more countries obedient. And of course, Europe hasn't had an independent foreign policy for, more than 80 years. And so, that's part of the story as well. And that gives, the two biggest, second and third biggest, I should say, China's got the biggest economy in the world now, but these are still, pretty close. And those two are allied. And that allows, of course, the U.S. to have, it's part of a system where the U.S. controls the IMF. It's not an exaggeration, really. In the last 25 years, Treasury has lost maybe three or four votes that they wanted to win at the International Monetary Fund. So,
maybe let's talk about that, because I don't think our listeners aren't necessarily paying close attention. So how is this working at the international level? Maybe you could actually describe the constellation of power and why so many countries go along with this global system that really does seem to center the United States.
Yeah, that is huge. And that is, by the way, why the sanctions are so important. I mean, we're going to get to migration, but I don't think, the sanctions are a horrible crime, and we have to say that a lot. And when that becomes, my view is that when that becomes known, just like, in 2019, we passed the War Powers Resolution in Congress, and that actually did make a difference in Yemen in terms of the, avoiding a big part of the killing that the United States was actively supporting militarily, with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And, that happened because it became indefensible. Okay. And so even got some Republican votes so it could pass both houses. And, Trump he doesn't care about the law or the Constitution, but it still had an impact. They stopped refueling the Saudi planes in midair, but I'm not going to go through that whole thing. But this is an example of how, why did it happen? Because people really found out about the war. In 2020, every Democratic presidential candidate had to say they were going to stop the war in Yemen, which was a war that, most Americans probably didn't even hear of. And of course, it had no press at all until a couple of senators started talking about it in 2016 and it developed a process. So that's what has to happen here, okay? When it gets to the point where it's widely known, and not only in Congress, but more publicly, and, you know, in an election year, for example, it can have even more impact, as the War Powers Resolution did. That's how it's going to end, because it's a horrible, indefensible crime that's taking place. Okay, so back to your question, how do they have this power? How does the So that is the rules-based international order, as it's called, that we're told, you know, is threatened, and terrible things will happen if the dollar, if the United States doesn't have this really unchecked and very unaccountable power that they have over the international financial system. So the IMF is a big player here, because that's the most powerful financial organization in the world. Not so much because of its size. The World Bank is actually quite a bit larger, but the IMF is the gatekeeper. It's set up that way. You know, a lot of these things are just set up. Like the president of the World Bank is always an American, since they were formed 81 years ago. And the IMF is always a European. A lot of people are confused about it. They think, well, Europe's got the IMF and we have the World Bank. No, it's not like that. The European head of the IMF is really someone that the United States approves. And the head of the IMF really does answer to the U.S. Treasury Department. As I said, I've been following this and writing about it for 25 years, and I can only point to, they were important votes, but they were only three or four votes where the U.S. Treasury lost. So, and they were recent years, so you could be optimistic and say, well, this is going to change. And actually, you know, I think it will, it's all going to change, okay? The question is the pace, right? We don't know how long it's going to take. But yeah, this system can't go on forever. I mean, look, everything is functioning as though we were still in 1944 or 46, when, you know, the U.S. was the practically the only standing industrial power, and, you know, and a huge part of the world didn't have independent governments. A lot of them were colonies. And so, you know, that's not true anymore. And China's already 25% bigger than our economy, okay? In as economists measure it, the press doesn't always get that right. And so this is going to change. But right now, this power is very strong, because you have the U.S. controller of the IMF, which, you know, gives it control over, you know, the other veto, not always, but, you know, almost all the time, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the other multilateral institutions. And then, of course, the World Trade Organization, you know, the alliance with Europe is solid there as well. And they wrote the rules. U.S. corporations really, that's a place where, you know, that they really kind of wrote the rules for the
They wrote the manual. just a quick question. So this is a question that I ask a lot about general U.S. foreign policy, imperial stuff. Does this benefit ordinary Americans?
That's a great question.
This is really that's the key so question, important. Right? Like, let's say it sucks for the rest of the world, blah, 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 but it's really awesome for, you know, the average Josephina in the United States. Is it or is it not? And it might be worth talking about that in some detail, because that really is the central question to some degree here.
It's really huge. And it's, yeah, and I would say, you know, nothing could be further from the truth than the idea that the majority of Americans benefit from the United States dominating the world in the way that it does. And you can see that in a lot of ways. Well, first of all, look at the sanctions. That's a relatively small, but it's still pretty big. You know, we showed that there's hundreds of thousands of jobs that would be saved in the United States, or created, if the IMF were to do another issuance, as they did in 21, of the special drawing rights, which is absolutely costless to the U.S. budget. And who's vetoing it at the IMF? It's the U.S. Treasury Department. And why? Because they care much more about, it's not even the Treasury Secretary necessarily. It's because the nobody pays that much attention to it. It's really decided by people inside Treasury, career officials, who want this, you know, they got the power of God over half the world, and they want to keep it that way. And so that's an institution where it hurts us. But it's much worse than that. I mean, look at the wars we have. I mean, I don't have to tell you how many wars in my whole life there's, you know, we've been at war most of the time. And it's hard to, you know, since World War II, it's hard to even point to one that really had something to do with preserving or protecting or increasing our national security here. In fact, it does the opposite. I live in Washington, D.C. I got a much better chance of getting killed here than I would have if the United States was a more of a peaceful and law-abiding country. I'm not that afraid of that. But, you know, the worst, the things that hit us directly, you know, the $1 trillion spent on military, and then we, you know, and how do we end up, you know, maybe that's a part of why we end up with health outcomes and life expectancy that's worse than almost all the other high income countries. And we end up with really very often bad governments as well as a result of this. You know, you look at Bush in 2002. I mean, a big part of the motive for the buildup to the Iraq war, I didn't even think they were going to invade after they got what they wanted. They, you know, that was to win the Congress when they had scandals and everything else. And so, you know, you get that thing too in our system, and you get presidents who can use that and candidates for political reasons. You get all the casualties we lost, thousands of people in the Iraq war, and everybody knows it was based on lies. I mean, nobody even tries to deny it. And we get a whole, you know, it corrupts all our politics, I think, in so many ways. I think partly it keeps people out of politics, out of electoral politics, who can't stomach the, you know, what our country is doing around the world. I think it does that too. But it also, you know, there's a whole number of ways in which it influences us here, and it's overwhelmingly negative. I mean, to be fair, there's a positive influence in the sense that, you know, having the dollar as the world's currency allows the United States to run, for example, trade deficits without worrying too much about them. We don't have to worry really much about our national debt as well and how much we owe overseas. I mean, for quite a long time, you know, a long period of time, although a lot of that's exaggerated too. But the having the dollar of the world, you know, that was how it was called and named, exorbitant privilege. It is a privilege in that sense, but it doesn't really trickle down when you look at all the costs of empire. And right now, you know, the threat of nuclear war even is pretty high. And we wouldn't have that if we were just looking out for ourselves and not trying to, control most of the world.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
So, Mark, I want to get back to the case of Venezuela and why these things are such a big driver of migration. We have to look at the effects that they have. And I'm more familiar with the case of Iran than I am with Venezuela, but I think broadly speaking, the effect has been the same. You get these broad sanctions imposed on a country that
block everything, block all transactions basically from taking place, or nearly all transactions. There have been, you know, ways to work around it that have developed as they've been, you know, overused, and countries have tried to find ways around it. But the response that always comes when you talk about, like, look, these things are preventing medicine from getting in, they're preventing food from getting, like, their people are going hungry, they're not able to find the basic things that they need to survive. The response always comes back from whoever's in power, whether it's the Trump administration or the Biden administration or whomever, that no, you don't understand. There are these humanitarian exceptions in place. We have these big carve outs for anybody doing business in these areas that are, you know, basic human needs. But they never work because the banking sanctions in particular prevent any economic activity from taking place, whether it's, you know, humanitarian or otherwise. Can you talk a little bit about why this is such a particularly revolting dodge to talk about these carve-outs that exist on paper but don't really seem to exist in practice?
Yeah, well, the Venezuelan case, it's kind of obvious. You know, you have this horrible depression and, you know, they can't, I mean, what was it? 2.8 billion in medical imports, and they had trouble even, you know, that was a big reduction. And they, you know, you can look at all the sectors, you can look at what happened to their economy, but just the collapse of the economy that resulted from that, when they're 90% or 95% of their exports are oil. I mean, there's just no way that even if you had, you know, a strict enforcement of these humanitarian exemptions, and I'll get to that in a second, you know, it wouldn't ever come close to saving people from the deaths and destruction that the sanctions can cause. It doesn't even make any logical sense. And then you have the reality, in addition, is that there's what some people call over-compliance. That is, the banks and everybody who's dealing with the government is going to be afraid from day one. Even when they do the individual sanctions, which we started here for Venezuela in 2015, you know, that had already a serious effect. As I said, you know, by 2016, it was really harming the economy. And that's because everybody knows what's next, too, that the bigger sanctions. But for sure, if you're doing the broader sanctions, and then 71% of those, by the way, or over 70%, are U.S. Sanctions. So that's the main actor here, you know.
There's no comparison, right? I mean, you take a bank, and the logic that has to go into this is, like, if I manage to get through the eye of the needle and deal with Venezuela in this very narrowly defined lane, okay. But if I stray outside of that, I'm risking, even to deal with a country like Venezuela, which has a lot of oil, a lot of wealth, potentially, the risk on the other side of this is I lose access to the dollar, I lose access to the SWIFT banking network, and I'm just out of business. There's no comparison there, right? When you're talking about risk assessment, it's just better to not deal with the country at all than to risk, you know, coloring outside the lines and getting penalized for it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so that's just never been, it's never had a serious impact on reducing these casualties when you have broad economic sanctions, having the humanitarian exemptions. I mean, I'm not going to say that it never, does anything. And when, you know, if there's legislation in Congress to do that, to create humanitarian exemptions, I definitely wouldn't oppose that. I'd support it, actually, but I wouldn't expect anything from it very much. And the main thing, as I said, is we've got a serious crime here, and we have to make sure that enough people know about it and get rid of it. And, you know, we focus a lot on Congress because that's the least unaccountable part of the U.S. Government. And so this is how we've gotten the changes that we have had, you know, like that 2021 issuance and the special drawing rights. And this is where we're developing, and of course, the War Powers Resolution. And then also, you know, we're developing more resistance in Congress. I mentioned Jim McGovern, but there's also been a letter now from 21 members of Congress. It was co-led by Congresswoman Escobar, who was at the time a co-chair of Biden's campaign, and it's calling for an end to the sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba. It did, and so you have it's making progress, and I think we're going to win it, but it's really tough because they're able to maintain so far for most people this fiction that sanctions are not this mass attack on civilians. You know, I didn't mention, I think that it actually fits the classic definition of terrorism, even in the Oxford English Dictionary, you know, the use of violence to force political changes. That's kind of what we were really looking at.
So, Mark, let's move more closely into the case of Venezuela and the real issue that we want to talk about here, which is the connection between the sanctions that the United States imposes and the flood of people out of a targeted country who then wind up at the U.S. border and are demonized again as, you know, asylum seekers or migrants with the door slammed shut in their face and you know, are treated brutally by this administration and past administrations as well. What does the research say first in terms of the effect that sanctions, U.S. sanctions have had on Venezuela? You've alluded to that already several times in the interview, but the connection between that and then, you know, the outflow of people from Venezuela.
Yeah. So, you know, Francisco Rodriguez, I told you, my colleague, he's estimated that of the 7 or so million people that have left Venezuela, which is huge, 4.2 or 4.3 million were a result of the sanctions. And, you know, the logic of this is pretty straightforward, right? You destroy people's livelihoods, you deprive them of medicine, and many people even food. You destroy the electricity and water infrastructure or damage it severely. And so people leave the country. It's, you know, I think that connection is pretty well established. It's established empirically as well from, you know, statistical studies that show that, that sanctions do lead to migration. And it's not just the statistical studies, but the case studies. When you look at these, you look at the countries that have had this damage from sanctions, it does cause people to leave. The medicine is another thing. That's a big thing, probably, you know, in Iran. But yeah, I think that it's an inescapable logic, and it's the empirical evidence is everywhere.
Let's maybe talk a little bit about the Trump administration's approach here, because you've talked, I know, about what set his first term apart. And what we've seen already in his second term in terms of the revival of maximum pressure. But can you, sort of comparing across administrations, what has made Trump's use of sanctions sort of stand out from Biden, from Obama, et cetera?
Well, I think Trump really did start the maximum pressure. That was the 2017 sanctions, and then the 2019 cutoff for the oil. So it was first the financial and then the oil sector, and then the secondary sanctions. So all of that was really huge. And yeah, that was 2020. February 2020 was the secondary oil sanctions on the buyers. So, you know, even just the first year, there were tens of thousands of people we estimated just based on mortality data, that died as a result of the first and the sanctions, and then the others were increasingly worse. So, but you know, on the other hand, Biden didn't do much to reverse any of that until quite recently. It allowed, you know, the Biden administration allowed some relaxation of the restrictions on oil exports, but it wasn't, you know, it was significant, but not nearly enough.
This is a thing that again also applies to the Iran case, but thinking about, you know, when the Biden administration came in, it had an opportunity to say these sanctions have done, you know, unspeakable things to the people of these countries. For moral reasons, we should get rid of them. You know, it's bad policy. We're harming civilians. But it didn't. It tried to take the sanctions that the Trump administration imposed during Trump's first term and use them as leverage, basically. It tried to leverage the sanctions on Venezuela for, you know, quote unquote, free and fair elections. It tried to leverage the sanctions that Trump reimposed on Iran and then, you know, went beyond, in many cases, what Obama had done to leverage, I mean, I guess a nuclear deal, although they stopped negotiating on that in a matter of months. So they didn't really even try to do anything with that stuff. But it seemed like they wanted to use these things as tools rather than get rid of them on their own principles. What is there an argument to be made that had they come in and just done away with these things, these countries would be in a better place now, even given the re-election of Trump and his return to office and the restoration of maximum pressure? What could we, you know, say about an alternative approach that Biden might have taken?
Yeah, it's so easy. You just you could do it with an executive order. It's, you know, an end to the sanctions. And, you know, I mean, the context is that the, you know, Venezuela for most of the years, you know, except for, you know, for example, the years of the Iraq War, for most of the years since Chavez was first elected in 99, Venezuela was the number one target for regime change for the United States and the world. So that's really what you're looking at. It doesn't change that much between administrations. And it isn't because of the oil per se, you know, the United States oil companies. In fact, and this is kind of an important point for people who are looking at this and trying to figure out why, you know, it's often assumed that it's, you know, corporate interests, their foreign policies dominated by that. And that's true for things like the WTO and, you know, NAFTA and the so-called trade agreements. And, you know, but it's not true for the kind of foreign policy. I mean, the United States has intervened in, you know, I don't know, in the 21st century. And, you know, I don't know how many, I'd have to add them up right now. We've written about most of them, you know, 8, 10 countries in various ways that had elected left of center governments. And so that's a default policy here. Here in Washington, D.C., if you say that countries ought to be able to choose their own governments, that's actually a kind of a radical idea in most circles here. I mean, people don't tell you that, but that is the practice. That's the main practice that you see. And a lot of the media looks at it like that. You know, in Bolivia, the military overthrew the government. It was a coup that was supported by the United States and, most importantly, the Organization of American States. So Secretary General was trying to, you know, get a second term and make sure that Trump and company liked him. And they just lied about the election result and created a whole false narrative. And you know, I could tell that whole story, but that's just one example of a regime change effort that the United States had an enormous impact, wouldn't have happened without our government. And it was, you know, it was a terrible thing. I mean, it was a coup led by white supremacists who were in the country that had the only indigenous president in the country with, you know, the most highest percentage of indigenous people. And it was horrible. And You know, that's just one. I could go through country by country, you know, and tell you how they helped keep Lula in jail in 2018 so that he couldn't run for re-election, which he would have won easily back then. You know, he left office with 83% of approval. So, you know, it would be a whole different hemisphere if not for these, for what the United States is doing in this hemisphere. We could have hours of discussion case by case. But I think that's where the sanctions fit in, right? Because that's the real power. And like I said, they have this power because they can get away with this more easily than they can get away with military intervention. When they bomb an apartment building or a wedding party in Afghanistan, that looks really bad. But this is not as much noticed. Just here, I want to just add one thing so you can see how the other side has said the quiet part out loud, too. This was Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State in 2019, and he's being asked by the press, you know, how is things going in Venezuela after they already lost 36% of their oil production since the 2017 Trump sanctions. And he says, well, we wish things to go faster, but I'm very confident that the tide is moving in the direction of the Venezuelan people and will continue to do so. The circle is tightening. The humanitarian crisis is increasing by the hour. And I talked with our senior person on the ground there in Venezuela last night. You can see the increasing pain and suffering that the Venezuelan people are suffering from. And then on Iran, just the previous month, he said, told CBS News, things are much worse for the Iranian people. And that's, you know, with the U.S. sanctions he was talking about. And we are convinced that will lead to the Iranian people to rise up and change the behavior of the regime. So there it is. I mean, this is, you know, it's open and it's almost never talked about.
I wanted to ask one more question about Trump, which is, you know, I know the center has done some writing about this, about the introduction of tariffs and thinking about his tariff approach, which admittedly has been pretty haphazard. They're on one day, they're off the next, you know, who knows from day to day what's going to happen. But it is thinking about these things in the same terms as we think about sanctions. Can you talk a little bit about that? Does it make sense to consider these things in the context of sanctions, or is it better thought of as a separate thing?
Well, the tariffs are unusual. I've written about that too. I mean, I think that the main purpose of the tariffs is to serve as a distraction. You know, because that's how Trump, as I'm sure you've seen this, you know, since he ran for office in 2016 and then through while he governs by distraction. This is the most extreme version of it. But, you know, you can see how this is a really tempting distraction for Trump because it allows him to just, you know, dominate the news instantly and then switch the subject. And that's what he uses it for. To promote his other narratives, which are more successful, you know, on migration and other things that he woke, whatever, and things that he wants to talk about. And I think that is really an effective tool that he's using it for. I don't know that he is trying to use it in the same way as sanctions, but it is, yeah, he does. It is. In some ways, it is. I mean, he's using it as a threat. And, you know, countries that go along with him are going to be treated better. And so it is, in that sense, it is similar to the sanctions. But I don't see it as the main purpose because it's not clear what he's going to get out of it. In fact, it's a little bit risky for him, right? He really is creating a lot of uncertainty in the U.S. and the global economy. And investors are, you just read the financial press. I mean, they're all saying, you know, we don't know what's going to happen the next day. Are we going to build a factory here or in other countries even sometimes? So I think You know, in Venezuela, in March, their exports fell by 11.5%. And there's some evidence that the threats of secondary tariffs on what on countries that import. So it is has something to do with sanctions, and it is in some ways a form, of sanction. But I think the overwhelming use of it is to allow Trump to dominate the media narrative as much as he, the other narratives as much as he can, and that he wouldn't be able to really do with other, as effectively with other distractions. But it is going to cause him problems. It already is.
So probably just to wrap up here, is it really possible for countries to move away from the dollar?
Oh yeah, definitely. And you will see more of that. I mean, you have countries that have currency swap arrangements, for example, with China and other countries that, you know, China's the largest trading partner for something like, or largest or second largest for, I think, 100 and around 120 countries. And that's a lot more than the U.S. now. And so you will see the substitution of other currencies bilaterally, for example, where they have swap agreements that allow them to avoid having to convert everything into dollars for their trade. I think you'll see more of that and other things too. And yeah, eventually you will see the dollar decline. I mean, the main as in terms of its share of commerce, but it's hard to say when, you know, because there isn't an organized substitute for it at this point. The euro was intended when it was introduced to be that kind of a substitute for some commerce, and it just never was able to do that for reasons that we could talk about.
I think that's would take us down a whole nother road. I think we're at a point where we should probably wrap up for now, but we can certainly have that conversation another time. But Mark, thank you so much again for coming on the program. The Center for Economic and Policy Research is CEPR.net for folks who want to check it out. Where else can people find your work?
I think we pretty much put it up there. I have my own personal website too, markweisbrot.com, but it's probably more on the CEPR.net, and of course there's a lot more material that's not from me on sanctions.
So folks, check that out. We'll have a link in the show description. Again, Mark, thanks so much. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.